Good day. I'm Jackie Judd with the Kaiser Family Foundation. Welcome to Books of Note. The last months or years of life are often the most complicated because of the health care system the ill and their families find themselves navigating. As modern medicine prolongs the last phase of life, improving that system of care becomes a far more critical issue. Dr. Joanne Lin has spent many years studying this issue and being a practitioner in the field. She is now a senior researcher at the RAND Corporation. Her book is Sick to Death, Reforming Healthcare for the Last Years of Life. Dr. Lin, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
You write in your book that this care system reflects its origins, powerful men worried about heart attacks. And you say that while that is an oversimplification, it is also fundamentally true. In what way? What have you seen to make you believe that?
Well, you know, in the enthusiasm of the 50s and 60s, we thought it was terribly important to invest in emergency medical systems and 911 and resuscitation and surgeries. And it worked. I mean, many people now live much longer and much healthier lives. But still, there's something bad in store for everyone. And we sort of failed to notice that there were going to be more and more people living with serious illness, that medical care was managing to keep them alive and in balance, but at the cost of constantly propping them up, and substantially disabled and often going for a long time before the end of life. It's now the most costly piece of life and by far the most disappointing to people. Families who are suddenly thrown into it are just overwhelmingly so frustrated that nothing works right, that one provider doesn't talk to the next, that one funding stream doesn't work with the next, that they're left adrift with the sickest people that they've ever seen.
Well, before we started this interview, and I was referring to the healthcare system, and you corrected me and said, well, it's not really a system. That would suggest some coordination. What works, in your view, least well?
Oh, my. What works least well? I mean, even just fundamental honesty about what we're up against probably starts the story. We don't put this phase of life on evening television. We don't talk about it. We don't develop economic models that make sense about the cost of a lifespan rather than the cost of a month. We don't require that one set of providers stay with a patient and family across time. We let that be, you know, dock-in-the-box services as if it was stopping by, you know, at a fast food joint, you know, each time he needed something. Whereas the patient, of course, has an experience over 3, 5, 10 years of serious illness. We would never put together services for pregnancy and delivery with a different provider in the 3rd month, and the 4th month, and the 5th month, and the 6th month. And here we have terribly sick people who are terribly fragile. And they could be seeing a different doctor every few days. They could see 12, 15, 20 doctors in their last 6 months routinely. None of whom talk directly to each other. They don't have the same records. The family's getting different stories. Nobody makes a plan ahead. How is it plausible that people come into the emergency room with established serious illness and no plan about whether they'll go on a ventilator? I mean, that should be just outrageous.
As I mentioned, you worked in this field. And in your book, you have some case studies. From your own firsthand experience, give me an example of a case that you saw that you thought kind of epitomizes what you're trying to get across in this book.
One way that we wrote up in Annals of Internal Medicine a couple years ago was a gentleman who was bouncing from nursing home to hospital and back again with mild dementia and chronic obstructive lung disease, emphysema. And he would be in the nursing home for a short time, then he'd get in trouble, and he'd go back to an emergency room. And, of course, the emergency room would be on reroute, so he'd go to a different emergency room. And when he got stable, he'd be sent to a different nursing home. And no one was talking with him or his family about what they wanted, what their plans should be, that he was up against a fatal disease or even a set of fatal diseases. And so he bounced back and forth and ended up in an intensive care unit on a ventilator. His family distraught over what they perceived to be a violation of his wishes, but of course nobody had ever gotten that all together. And what was striking about that was, in writing it up, at every level, as people looked at it, the editor, the peer reviewers, and so forth, they'd say, but this isn't really a mistake in the care system. And you say, by what definition of mistake? Is this not one?
But were they trying to say to you, this is the way it's supposed to work?
No, just this is what we tolerate. This is, you know, sort of the way things are. It would be like, you know, making peace with horses when you've developed automobiles. You know, I mean, people were just so used to having the care system being dysfunctional in these ways that the providers have made it plausible not to even see the shortcomings.
And Medicare, of course, is a piece of this. And Medicare, over the years, has helped tens of millions of people. But in what ways do you think Medicare contributes to what you view as being wrong in all of this?
Well, Medicare was designed around the idea that patients could have a procedure and be put back on track. So if you go back and look at the cases that were presented in the early 60s, mm-hmm. they're heavily somebody who couldn't save up enough for a surgery and therefore was disabled. And if only they could get their cataract fixed or their hernia fixed or whatever, then they would do so much better. And there must have been quite a backlog of such cases at the time. But now, I mean, Medicare takes care of that well. What Medicare was never really designed around was the idea that people were going to be teetering on this tightrope of sort of barely holding it together to stay alive for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. And so there's no element in Medicare that encourages continuity. There's no element that requires that you share records, that you plan ahead, that the family get any support. We're just about the only Western nation that doesn't have any organized policy for the support of family caregivers. And yet the family is all of a sudden presented with this terribly sick person who's had a stroke or their heart has now had a bad heart attack and they really are not going to be able to breathe well. And they're expected to somehow pull this all together.
At their most vulnerable time.
Right. And often with a very elderly spouse or even now elderly children. You know, we have 94-year-old patients being cared for by 70-year-old children. We say children and we have this image that it's a 40-year-old, and it often isn't. So people are all of a sudden expected to learn how to handle dressings and bed changes and spoon feeding and all these things for a person who they love, or even if they don't love them, they're bonded to them. And they're given almost no support, almost no training, no respite, no health insurance, no Social Security benefits. A woman who takes off at age 55 to take care of her mother with dementia, 7 or 8 years later is ready to enter the workforce again. And, of course, she has a pre-existing condition and is almost certain not to get a job or none with health insurance. And she will have wiped out her own pension.
In your prescription for change or your remedy for change, you talk about needing to come up with something that reflects the patterns of need rather than a diagnosis or a place of care. Fill that idea in. Give me the top 3 or 4 recommendations.
Well, it seems that you would think that there would just be millions of ways people would come at the end of life. And of course, everybody's story is in fact their own. But there are certain patterns that tend to recur. There's a pattern with very bad cancers, say lung cancer or colon cancer, where the person really does pretty well until their last couple of months when they really lose weight, do badly, take to bed. That was the image we had in mind when building hospice programs, and they actually could work fairly well. But there's a second pattern, which is the person who goes in and out of the hospital over and over again, being rescued from heart disease, rescued from lung disease, something like that. And nobody gets around to saying, you too have a fatal disease, and we need to be planning around the fact that at some point the rescue isn't going to work. These people need good disease management and excellent advanced care planning and the ability to move services to the home in that last piece of time when they're otherwise would be just so worn out to go anywhere. And then the majority of us actually now face frailty and dementia, which is long-term serious disability. Not terribly sick on a day-to-day basis, but needing someone to provide supervision or spoon feeding or keep you clean or get the groceries in or those sorts of things that go on for years and years. Half of us who live to 85 will have dementia. When we think about what the impact of that is going to be as all the boomers get old, already it's probably about 40% of us die with a course like that. So if we built care systems around even just those three populations, probably could serve 80% or more of all of us who die.
But what does that care system look like? I mean, for example, what does the doctor do differently in your way of thinking than now?
I think there's some critical elements. One is that the same care team follows you in almost every setting. So you have a doctor, nurse, social worker, maybe a few doctors working together and a few nurses and social workers, but it's a relatively compact group that when you're in the hospital, they're managing the care. When you're at home, when you're going into hospice, when you're in a nursing home for a little while after a surgery. So they get to really know you, know the strengths of your family, and are an enduring presence in your life. So we don't think of it as an episode of care. We think of it as, well, once you're this sick, you need somebody to stay with you all the way through to the end of your life. Mm-hmm. So one thing is the enduring nature and across all settings. One is that those teams have to be able to handle sort of 90% of everything that's likely to arise. Blood pressure issues, diabetes, family discord, pulling in resources to fix the roof. I mean, they have to be able to call on all the right services. Each individual family member can't learn all those things around their particular
family. But you're suggesting that a part of the medical team actually look after things in the house?
Sure. It's social services every bit as much as it is medical services. They've got to be integrated. The person who can't stay at home because they can't get groceries in needs a way to get the groceries in.
And why would you want a medical team to be involved in that?
Well, it doesn't have to be a medical team. I mean, we could call it an advanced illness team. There has to be a medical presence because these patients are on 12 or 15 drugs and they've got, you know, 7 or 8 major illnesses. So there's got to be a medical presence. But the heart of it really is a service orientation toward the patient and family, and is much more anchored in nursing. Mm-hmm. In general than in traditional
medicine.
And
social work as well.
And social work, especially on those long-term frailty and dementia patients. You were saying, though, how this shifts from where we have been. Mm-hmm. You know, when I was in medical school, we were taught diagnosis by diagnosis, and you could think of those as rows on a grid. Then you get out in practice and you realize, no, it's actually organized by setting. So it's hospital intensive care or hospital ward or nursing home or home care. And we think of excellence as excellence where those cross. So this is the best nursing home for dementia care, or this is the best hospital for heart surgery. And what you realize is that toward the end of life, people ordinarily have 7 or 8 diagnoses, and they need 3 or 4 settings of care. We don't even have a way to think about excellence. And the thinking about excellence, it seems, has to start from the kind of population to be served. And if we said, well, how could we, here in Washington, build in Washington, D.C., a care system that would serve heart and lung failure patients toward the end of life in a really excellent way? And you would have 24/7 on call. You'd have somebody able to go to the home within an hour, day or night. You'd never let a patient get off their medications. That the very first sign they were getting into trouble, there'd be a way to be on the phone and giving them the right medications and trying to keep them out of trouble. They'd always have an advanced care plan, so you'd know if they wanted to be on a ventilator and if there were limits on how long to be served. We would have to do it relatively geographically, because at any one time there are only 400 or 500 people in the city that's sick. So you couldn't...
Really sick, you mean?
This sick, the kind of $45,000 a year kind of service.
Right, end of life sick.
Yeah. So I think we have to think about, you know, what is the population to be served in one area? How would you organize the service array? They could still keep the same doctors as long as there was a way to share records and the on-call and the expertise. We'd do the same thing around dementia and frailty. We would have ways of supporting the families, trying to make sure families got the kind of respite care and training they needed. But then we would have the rhythm be over years. We would be digging in and expecting the person's going to need this for a long time.
And a final question. Everything you've described sounds wonderful and terribly, terribly expensive. Number one, is it? And if it is, how do we afford more when all you hear about these days is how difficult it is to support the systems we have in place now?
Yeah, this is the one area of medicine or of healthcare in which we probably are spending about as much as we need to, at least on a per capita basis. I mean, as the boomers come in and we have so many more people, there's going to be some increase. But on a per person basis, we are throwing away so much money in inefficiency that the opportunity is there to actually do it right at just about the same cost. Now, for any one person, maybe it goes up a little, but for somebody else, it goes down some. Mm-hmm. You know, The person who is encouraged to take a last-ditch chemotherapy, and it costs $40,000, and they're in their last 3 weeks. Well, if instead you said, you know, we can put in place really good supports, your family will never be in the lurch, they'll never feel afraid, it'll still be very hard to die. I mean, no one is a Pollyanna about that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, think about whether you really want to go through one more round of getting nauseous and all the side effects of the therapy. But the doctors right now are in a situation in which all of the financial and even social expectation incentives are on the side of continuing to treat aggressively. Well, if instead we said, well, no, at some point we really ought to be honest with patient and family and help them come to a sense of how they want to orchestrate their end of life, mm-hmm. there's every good reason to think that it actually saves money. Now, on the whole, I mean, it saves money in hospitalization, it saves money in drugs, and but if people live a little longer because they're less anxious, or if they, if sometimes getting some support in for the family that we didn't otherwise do costs some, it probably ends up just about balancing out. But there's no reason to think that on a per-person basis, the costs have to go up.
Final word. Thank you very much. It was very interesting to have you here. We appreciate it. Dr. Joanne Lin is the author of Sick to Death, Reforming Healthcare for the Last Years of Life. I'm Jackie Judd. Thank you for joining us on Books of Note. Good day.